Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors.
Good morning.
Hi.
I'm Borskut Idenola from Gresham House PLC. I'm an investment director in the Gresham House New Energy Group. For those of you who don't know Gresham House PLC well, we're a London-listed manager of alternative investments with £2.6 billion under management at the moment. And we're active in the areas of infrastructure, forestry, renewables, energy storage, the opportunity I'm going to take you through right now, private equity, as well as small cap quoted equities. My colleagues are here at the stands, and they can give you much more information about Gresham House PLC if you'd like to receive that. I'm here to introduce the Gresham House Energy Storage Fund, which helpfully we managed to get the ticker GRID for. It's a London-listed fund, and it's a fund that has been put in place to capitalise on the vast opportunity offered by energy storage, the growth of energy storage in the UK. Let's start by focusing on the picture, which shows a typical energy storage plant that the fund owns. And it would be this kind of plant that's in the pipeline that will be acquired by the fund going forward as well. It consists of batteries, which are located in standard 40-foot containers, as well as the inverters that are designed to convert voltage from DC to AC to feed back into the grid, transformers, the associated cabling, and in some cases for hybrid projects, gas or diesel generators, as well as all the associated cabling and control system operating room, again located in containers. These have typically a very small footprint. They're typically located over 1 to 2 acres of land. They have a grid connection to the nearest grid connection point, they capitalize on the energy storage opportunity by either through market-based mechanisms, by trading in the energy market, or through contracted revenue streams. But I will explain in the presentation how we do that. I'm going to dedicate about 25 minutes to going through the slides, and because it's a fairly new opportunity, I'd like to sort of put a larger than normal weighting to questions, as I anticipate that there will be quite a few. I will firstly take you through the summary. The fund was, we're talking about a fund that's already trading. We raised £100 million through an IPO on the London Stock Exchange in November of 2018. £60 million of that went towards buying already operational projects. So from day one, this fund had a yield. And the remaining £40 million is now committed to another 60 megawatts of energy storage projects, which have either been built or where construction is about to start. We're here because at the moment we're going through a placing of 75 million extra shares, up to 75 million extra shares, which are sold at a price of 101p. The fund was launched at 100p, and that was announced on the 26th of April. It will be closing at the end of next week on the 24th of May. We will deploy the proceeds that we have raised into opportunities that we already have in the pipeline that are ready to build, really with the purpose of minimizing cash drag by the end of Q1 of 2020. So our target is to have deployed all of the funds, the surplus funds that we raised, plus what we're raising now into revenue earning opportunities within the next 10 months. The NAV total return target for the fund is 8% on an unlevered basis, but we see the potential to raise that to 15%. The portfolio is unlevered at the moment. As we build, bring in leverage, and that's an active stream of work for us. We're in conversations with several lenders. We can bring in additional returns, and we can bring in additional returns from efforts on the revenue side as well as the cost side, and upgrading existing projects, either through getting extra grid connection capacity, which would enable us to add more batteries as well, or on the cost side, through scale, as we build scale, costs that typically start high, operational costs that typically start high in new markets, drift down, so that will also offer additional returns, and we expect to get to we expect to be able to get to 15% NAV level returns over time. Financial highlights, the NAV at the moment is 99.9p per share. After the IPO, it was 98p as a result of the launch costs. We've announced our first dividend of 1.4p per share that will be payable at the beginning of next month. That's part of the 4.5p that we have committed to and for which we have reaffirmed our commitment that will be paid this year. And the underlying, so far, the underlying revenue performance has been very strong for the funds. We're working on upgrades to deliver incremental returns. And on a technical basis, our plants have operated very well. We've had 99.95% availability on the plants until today. From an operational point of view, I will take you through a revenue stream called Triads, which is a market-based mechanism designed to reduce volatility on the grid. We have earned 3 out of 3 of those, and that's really contributed to our strong revenue performance. And as I mentioned earlier, we're already working with lenders on bringing debt at portfolio level, debt of up to 50% leverage. Moving on to the key investment characteristics. I mean, firstly, unlike energy funds, public funds in the energy sector right now typically offer access to renewable power generators or other generators, and the risk investors are taking is the risk of power prices as well as subsidies, what will happen to subsidies over time. This is a completely different proposition. This is an asset-backed proposition, just like investing in other areas of the energy sector, but it is a play on the volatility of the energy sector, not on absolute power price levels and not on subsidies. As a consequence of the huge deployment of renewables, as I will show to you, volatility has increased, and all the factors are in place for that volatility to increase, and we need a mechanism for that essentially to be able to reduce the volatility on the grid, and energy storage plants can do that and also earn very strong returns in the process. The fund offers a quality income yield. It has a high EBITDA margin, and it has a diversified cash flow profile. We're not dependent on any one revenue stream. We're dependent on a revenue stack with a degree of transferability between different revenue streams that reduces risk. The fund, in our view, has strong capital growth potential. The seed assets were acquired through as a result of an independent valuation process at an IRR of 12%. That compares to IRRs of less than 6% that are used. Actually, it's a range of sort of 5% to 7.5% for renewable generation assets, around 8 to 9% for merchant power assets. We started at 12%, and that is, I guess, typical of the sort of evolution of risk profile in new markets. When assets are first brought to market, sold, they start at a high discount rate. But as we have seen in the case of renewable energy generation, as the market becomes more comfortable, as a business model is demonstrated, that yield falls over time. So there is an inherent yield compression and capital appreciation potential in the fund. The aggregation of investments in one portfolio offers portfolio diversification, so we're not dependent on any single one plant, and we can gain extra benefits from having a diversified portfolio on the revenue side as well as on the cost side. There is also capital growth potential from lease extensions. Our projects have lease periods that vary between 25 and 40 years. As we extend those over time, typically the impact is closer as you get towards the end of the lease. There is a potential to add to NAV. And there is also the potential to add to NAV through, as I mentioned, getting additional grid capacity or installing more batteries on the site over time as that delivers a strong incremental return. As I mentioned, the returns are uncorrelated to the absolute level of power prices. We think this is a very important differentiator. Very strong asset backing, again, like other renewable energy investments. It's between 60 and 70% of the total capital cost is in equipment, easily movable equipment, the batteries, the inverters, the transformers, etc. And that level rises to actually close to 80% when the cost of the grid connection is also brought into that has a value in its own right into play. Scale and first mover advantage, we're the largest owner of these assets in the market, independent owner of these assets in the market. we're well positioned to benefit from scale as we grow our asset base. I mean, we're going from 70 megawatts at the moment to close to 260 megawatts by the end of the first quarter of 2020. That will really help. And we have very carefully thought about managing the risk-reward profile of this fund. This is a new market. There is no denying that. And in our view, it was much more suitable to offer investors a proposition of owning operational assets than taking any development or construction risk. Construction process is actually quite simple, as I sort of explained to you. It's a sort of small footprint, it's containerized solutions, but the development process is very complex. A lot more effort needs to go into designing these plants and catering for all different types of scenarios. So we don't want investors to take that risk. So it buys fully operational assets, takes absolutely no development risk or construction risk. And quite importantly for most of you, this fundamentally supports the drive towards a low carbon economy. It will enable the further growth of renewables. It will enable a decarbonisation of the energy sector. So it has a positive social impact. As I mentioned, the IPO proceeds are now fully committed. It bought 70 megawatts of operational assets, and the rest are committed to the pipeline that we have at the moment. Those are shown at the bottom table, the first three lines. And with the proceeds of the secondary offering we're carrying out at the moment, we will deploy that into the projects, the four projects shown at the bottom of the table. These are all at ready to build phase. Why is this such an interesting opportunity? I'd like to take you through the market background at this stage. And we believe the electricity market in the UK, and actually many other, you can translate that to many other geographies of the world, is at a tipping point at the moment. It's at a tipping point because renewables penetration has risen much faster than forecast. And now is at a level where more than close to 45% of electricity generated comes from renewables. People have consistently underestimated how quickly renewables penetration would rise, and we show that in the first chart. We compare forecasts that were put in place in 2017 by BEIS and forecasts that were put in place in 2019, only 2 years afterwards. And you can see the huge difference, how much the market has underestimated renewable penetration. Now, this is not just a function of renewables deployment, it's also a function of coal-fired power plants being decommissioned, but the net effect is the same. Low carbon electricity generation that also includes nuclear and biomass now is a dominant form of power generation in the UK and in many other countries of the world. And going forward, this picture will only shift in favour of low carbon energy generation because offshore wind, there are still a lot of offshore wind projects in the pipeline that have banked subsidies in the past that are in the construction queue. Furthermore, there are developers of solar and wind assets who are not relying on any subsidies, for whom the business model makes sense, selling into the wholesale markets through PPA arrangements. So there are going to be more and more renewables coming online. And we're at a point where, as I will show, it's at a tipping point because that has had an effect of a manifest increase in volatility on the electricity grid. What volatility now is persistent, and as a result of this volatility, a lot of renewable generation is being wasted. The top chart shows a daily price spread over time in the recent period. There is a clearly increasing trend in volatility. That volatility can cause oversupply at times when the wind is blowing. Solar power generation is also high, and there's very little energy demand. And it can also create a lot of undersupply because renewable generation, which has now become the dominant form of power generation, is not there to meet demand in evening hours when energy demand is very high. And this situation will only get worse over time as more and more renewable generation is added to the mix. At the moment, a lot of wind energy is being wasted. Around 6% of wind power in 2019 so far has been wasted, according to our estimates. Oversupply, for the designers of the overall electricity grid, if you spoke to National Grid 5 years ago, they had planned the electricity grid so that oversupply would be a rare event. Oversupply now is a very regular event. we get daily swings into negative pricing. And on the 24th of March, 2 months ago, we had 6 instances in one day where the power price went negative due to oversupply. Investing in battery storage offers a hedge for renewable investments as well. When you think about it, renewable generation is actually a fairly inflexible form of asset. You have to sell your power when you generate it. And because everybody's in the same boat, times of oversupply are when all the renewable generators are generating at the same time, and that leads to a collapse in prices. Many of them get subsidies, but there are a lot that have been built in recent years and that are being built at the moment, where there is a much larger dependence on power prices going forward. So that creates a huge inflexible situation. By contrast, batteries can trade, enter the market whenever there's an attractive price signal or there's an attractive contract in place for the batteries to yield energy. So batteries offer much more flexibility. If you look at the first chart, that chart shows the correlation between the amount of wind energy that is produced on the system and prices on the system. As the wind energy price, we show that as the volatile line, and there's an average line as well that sort of goes through that smooths that out. There's a clear correlation between power prices and the amount of wind energy on the system. As wind energy rises, prices fall, and vice versa. And at the bottom chart, we show what the wholesale power price has done. In the past, it was mainly one-off spikes due to undersupply. But if you look at the very bottom, which magnifies the recent period, now we're getting a lot of negative prices as well, which really works. The reason why batteries are becoming more interesting right now is that it's very difficult to trade undersupply bits. Very frequent oversupply events are a lot more predictable and are a lot more easier to trade. Hence, the opportunity is there at the moment. How do we earn our revenues? We earn our revenues through a stacked revenue approach, and we target 5 areas. The first area is asset optimization. That is essentially trading in the market through 3 mechanisms: the day-ahead market, the intraday market, and the balancing mechanism. They're all mechanisms designed to really where you buy power at a certain price and you sell power at a price where you feel you will get the maximum risk-adjusted return. We have started doing this for one of our plants. Previously, our plants were on the earning the fast frequency response service, which I will come to. And we're doing this through working with partners, large energy firms, who have been in the trading business for a long time. The approach we're taking is that because this is a relatively new area, we will work with strong partners first. It means that we yield a percentage of our revenues, but it offers us a much better risk-adjusted return. And asset optimization will be the core of the revenue stream going forward. Frequency response is a contracted service. The National Grid in the UK has the obligation to balance supply and demand at all times. And very short-term supply and demand imbalances causes a deviation in the grid frequency from 50 hertz on the grid. And there is a service, a contracted service, that is designed for plant owners to react very quickly, and batteries are ideal for this. A battery is a mechanism that can react very, very quickly to a price, to a signal. And that's a contracted mechanism. It was our route to market because there were some very, very attractive contract rates in the past. As these have declined, we will be looking to sort of opportunistically act in this market, but not in a way that limits our potential to trade. We will limit it to certain hours of the day when we're unlikely to either draw or export power from the grid. There is also the capacity market, which is a mechanism under review as a result of an application that was made by one party that arguing that state aid rules were breached. This is a mechanism, a 15-year mechanism, to ensure that there is capacity on the system to meet extreme needs. It's essentially an insurance policy that's being put forward by the grid. We believe this will come back. It's a very small part of our revenue streams, but if it doesn't come back, it will increase volatility. Hence, this is what I mean by the transferability between different revenue streams. There are also grid-related payments depending on where on the network the asset is located. different areas have got different specific payments because they might have local constraints. And this also includes the triad mechanism, which is a mechanism designed to incentivize supply and disincentivize consumption in winter periods. And there are also additional revenues that might become available. Certain industrial users want a very, very stable, carefully sculpted power profile. Batteries can do that. We're looking at that for one of our future projects. There's a potential to launch bilateral agreements with transmission system operators like the National Grids or DNOs, the local electricity providers, as well as new services that will emerge over time and other bolt-on business activities. And these split as follows. We earn around 70% of our revenues from asset optimization. Firm frequency response is a smaller part. Again, we will act in this market opportunistically. It's only around 11%. Capacity market is 9%. Triads are 7%. But more importantly, this table shows that a megawatt of energy storage capacity that costs typically between £500,000 to £600,000 all in for a 75-minute battery capacity, which is all that is needed for us to implement our strategy, can deliver a revenue yield of between 13% and 15% over time. Given the high EBITDA margin, this means that a cash flow we can deliver the cash flow yield numbers that I have mentioned. This revenue stream can become more stable as well if we so choose, because some of the counterparties we work with on trading are at a stage now where they can offer minimum floors, guarantees of revenue when they work to optimize our assets for us. Our competitive advantages, I'd like to go through those quickly. Really at fund level, I think very importantly, we've got an operating history. We've developed, built and operated projects. Our oldest project has more than 2 years of operating history. Many other players in the market don't have that. We've got a lot of data that we've collected that we're analysing very carefully. We've got a control system that's worked for our projects, with a two-year operating history. We think that's a strong advantage. Our market share is another advantage. We're the largest owner, and hence we have the opportunity to deliver incremental returns on the revenue side and on the cost side. We've got a diversified portfolio. We're not dependent on one asset. We have a low-cost operational structure. Over time, we have developed a repeatable design, putting a lot of work into it. As I mentioned earlier, it's not constructing these sites that's difficult, it's designing these sites that's difficult. That's designing them in a way where they can really switch very easily between different revenue streams is a difficult task. We have done that. And we've got a single control system. What enables us to do that is a single control system that operates, that's capable of operating all sites as one, that can integrate multiple technologies, batteries as well as gas generation where needed. And that can very seamlessly switch between different revenue modes. Our team, which is shown later in the presentation, has got over 100 years of asset management or finance sector experience between them. The core team has worked together for close to 10 years, over 30 years of project development and asset ownership experience. We have designed business model and projects that implement that business model. And very importantly, we've got strong relationships with National Grid and the DNOs. The National Grid relationship is very important because it's their mandate to keep the grid stable. It's very important to have that dialogue to understand regulatory changes that could potentially yield new revenue opportunities. It's important to maintain a relationship with the DNOs in terms of connecting projects, but also understanding the scope for additional revenue streams on a local level. The other advantage is an understanding of O&M gained from essentially managing, owning renewable generation assets since 2010. That has taught a lot about how risk sharing with contractors, incentive mechanisms, what could go wrong. Sometimes it's not the large items, it's the small items. So we have a long list of experiences we've had of, you know, how small, careful attention to very small things that people miss can actually really help protecting revenues. Our trading partners, those are the parties I mentioned who we work with on the asset optimization side to trade in the market. They've got big teams who are focused on this with a lot of experience. We are entering into deals with them. where risk and revenues are shared in a fair way, in our view. And our focus as a team is really the revenue potential, increasing that, keeping a good alignment in place with the funds, clearly separating out development and asset ownership activities through independent processes and verification, as well as bringing down costs. This is the case for the upside return. We can go from 8% to 15%, mainly through leverage, which brings in 4%. Optimization income, there's a potential to bring another 1% from there. From lease extensions, there's a potential to bring another 80 basis points. And through O&M cost reductions, there's a potential to bring another 20 basis points of incremental return. Very important component is a company called Norica Power. We're in a joint venture with them for project development work. As I said, the design process is very complicated. And this is a team of people who've got very strong experience in control system design and also operating ENGIE sites, designing them. We work very closely with them in the project development process to ensure that the construction process is very simple. We get good prices and we can transfer risk well in EPC contracts that we negotiate with EPC counterparties. They're also a very large stakeholder in the fund. They own around 3% of the fund. All of the team members, myself, Ben Guest, Gareth Owen, we're also large investors in the fund. So we're strongly incentivized. We have a very large percentage of our own personal worth in the fund. To conclude, I think, you know, through the ENGIE storage funds, we're offering the opportunity to participate in what is a very clear, in our view, irrevocable trend, and that is the growth of renewables on the system. Low carbon energy is a dominant form of power generation, and inevitably that is leading to increased volatility. This is not a thesis. We're experiencing that now on the grid, hence the opportunity to capitalize on that right now. It's an asset-backed opportunity with diversified cash flows. And very importantly, it's not correlated to power prices. Our view is that in the long run, these are going to fall. And not having exposure to that, or at least hedging exposure an investor has through investments in renewable energy funds is, I think, an important differentiator for this. The fund provides essential infrastructure that supports the government in meeting its long-term targets. It offers an optimal solution to deal with the intermittency of renewables and managing stability on the grid. It's got strong asset backing. As Gresham House, we've got proven expertise because we have operated these for over 2 years. We've got a ready-to-build pipeline, which once built will be sold into the fund. We don't have to go and, you know, now that we've raised the money, go and scramble to find these opportunities. It creates a very significant cash drag for investors. We don't have that problem. Very importantly, there's a potential for this to follow what every other infrastructure opportunity has followed, new infrastructure opportunity has followed, which starts at high returns. But as the asset class becomes more mainstream, there is a potential for this, for energy storage to grow by 30-fold on the electricity grid as a result of renewable penetration. And we show that on page 19 in the chart, in the presentation. We're coming in early, and this offers the potential for yield compression, capital appreciation, as well as the regular dividend stream. I'd like to conclude the sort of prepared remarks here and just take questions from you.
My question is on the durability of the revenues. What do you think are the biggest risks to the revenues of the fund? And also another question, whilst I've got the microphone, is to do with the state subsidy issue around the EU and the capacity market. Well, where are we on that in terms of the EU and the ongoing debate about the viability of that?
Mm-hmm. Let's start with the risks to the revenue streams. Really, there are two major risks. One is market and regulatory risk, and counterparty risk on one hand, and there's also operational risk on the other hand. The first is about if we operate well, can we earn the revenue streams? The second is, even if the revenue streams are there, can we earn those revenues? With the first, I think we're encouraged. When the sector first started, it was mainly on contracted mechanisms. So we started off with very attractively priced FFR contracts that drifted down over time. As the market realized that it wanted to move to a much more market force dominated mechanism. And asset optimization is that we're essentially buying and selling power in the day. There isn't a regulatory framework that can strongly affect that. We're front of the meter. We have supply licenses. We can enter. We can trade power. What could happen, of course, is that as with any other opportunity, capital markets are very efficient here. You can have more and more assets that come online and gradually compress that daily spread. However, we take comfort from precisely this chart that at the moment there's around 450 megawatts of front-of-the-meter energy storage capacity in the UK. That's set to increase very, very rapidly. I mean, within over 30-fold by 2020, and then going forward from that point as well, a very, very strong increase in flexible generation capacity. So I don't think growth will catch up fast enough for that revenue stream to narrow. We've got several years of very, very strong daily power price spreads in front of us. We take comfort from the diversification. So if that happens too slowly, volatility will stay. And National Grid absolutely has no choice but to stick to its mandate of maintaining price stability. So it can stop. It will have to go back to contracted services, which are plants are designed flexibly so that they can switch to that kind of revenue mode. The other side is really, the growth of renewables. I mean, there's so much growth still in the queue, projects that have already banked subsidies, so there's no risk of losing those. They will be built. A lot of them have been financed, so that growth will continue. On the operational side, we focus on really acquiring plants, which have been built by very good EPCs under EPC contracts that transfer risk very well over to the EPC contractor through mechanisms that punish them if the site isn't properly designed and properly constructed. We put a lot of emphasis on insurance against business interruption cover, against extreme events. And we put a lot of emphasis on what we have learned operating and maintaining renewable sites, really focusing on the small things that could be very small cost could be very small in terms of maintaining them, but if we get it wrong, it can really affect revenue. So we apply that knowledge there. So we believe those are the key risks. In terms of the capacity market, that process is still ongoing. I think our view is that the system needs standby capacity to cope with very extreme events. If it doesn't come back, we're not very dependent on that. And the loss of that revenue stream, which amounts to around 7%, will be compensated by what we will earn on asset optimization, because extreme events will get more extreme. And we're positioned to be able to benefit from that.
Thank you. Just a couple questions about how you could be disrupted. So National Grid might be nationalized soon if we're unlucky. And I've recently seen that Shell is providing electricity services, and that suggests they might have a lot of idle-handed engineers that could turn their mind to what you do in a scale that's far beyond at the moment what how you're operating, unless you were lucky and they bought you.
Mm-hmm. I think we've seen that in renewables. I mean, these start as sort of typically small industries where independent players are active. And over time, energy companies realize that they have to be in this market as well to hedge their ownership of energy generation assets and exposure to power prices. And there's no question that over time they will go into this market, but we haven't seen too many signs of that happening yet. Typically, the path that is followed is that they wait for established, for independent operators to sort of establish themselves, deliver a bit of scale, and then come and buy those assets and grow on the back of that. We've seen a very similar thing happening in the energy electric vehicle charging space. I mean, it's a sort of much more nascent industry to this, but rather than building out their own infrastructure, they've tended now to sort of acquire what other people have done and build on the back of that. But there's absolutely no doubt they're going to become important players in this space as well. They have to be able to diversify their revenue streams.
And National Grid being
nationalize?
That's something which is very difficult for us to predict. But even if it were nationalized, the mandate to maintain grid stability cannot go away. They still have to have the same mandate. They still have to procure, if their access to capital goes down as a result of nationalization, which I think is a big risk for National Grid, then they'll be reliant increasingly on external parties to be able to provide the function that they need to provide to stabilize the electricity grid. I mean, it's very difficult to predict because, in an extreme event like that, you don't know where dominoes will ultimately fall. But it's clear that their access to capital will come down if that happens. And the fact that the mandate to manage electricity supply and demand, that's not going to go away. They still have that mandate.
So a technology question is that you're in a period of growth and you say you've been operating equipment for 2 years. What about the equipment that you're using? What is the history of its stability and reliability and the service providers to make sure that equipment keeps working?
Sure.
Thank you. In addition to your point about BI, which is good.
Yeah. Thank you for that question. If we look at the main equipment, that's the transformers, the inverters and the batteries. Now, inverters and transformers have a very long history of operating, so they're not complex equipment. They've been around for a long time. And we have experience of managing plants with inverters that goes back 10 years. So we're not too worried about that, but we do try and get the longest possible and best warranty terms from manufacturers. And we don't, when we buy projects, go to the sort of more extreme ends of things in order to reduce costs. The aim is to buy equipment from the best manufacturers. So, for instance, of the existing fleet, inverters have come from SMA and from Emerson, which are well-established companies. The same goes for transformers. They've been around for 150 years almost. Actually, no, 130 years. And, we get good warranties. We work with good manufacturers. With batteries, it's arguably a bit different. Lithium-ion technology has been around since the mid-90s. But how long has it been applied in scale, of this kind of scale? How long has it been applied where you put 4 megawatt hours into one container? That operating history is much more limited. But again, we minimize that through working with the best manufacturers, LG Chem and Samsung are the manufacturers we work with. Again, we don't go to the sort of other scales of people who offer cheaper solutions. And very importantly here, we insist on 10-year warranties. So we have warranties that are very carefully designed that tell us what parameters we have to stick to. But as long as we stick to those parameters, we have a 10-year warranty for those batteries. So with the batteries, we have to be much more careful about managing the precise risk that you have. And we do that through very long warranty terms.
Thank you.
Thank you.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.